Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, Gladys and Potties. Welcome to another Late Night Live. Shortly, Bruce Shapiro on the 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. Then you'll meet an independent writer, Stephen Starr, who's going to tell us what nuclear war might have to do with climate change. And then Babette Smith is going to call in and discuss the convict stain, so-called, which for many, many years, generations in Australia, was like a provincial version of original sin. And Babette thinks that the convict stain is, well, it's wrong. There's good reason for feeling quite proud of the convict and not hiding our convict origins, if indeed you have them. But first, it is my sad duty to comment on the death of John Button, whom I've known for the best part of, over 40 years. We all knew that time was running out for John, and I can't tell you what a hit, what a thump it is to know that he's died. Memories for me come rushing back. The most powerful is the most tragic. And I'm sitting in the back garden of the Buttons' home in Hawthorne, just after his son's body had been taken away in the ambulance following his OD on heroin. Happier memories, though, I think deserve attention. One of them is John and I find ourselves on a flight back from Cairo, by coincidence. And I remember the long conversation we had between Cairo and Sydney where he was attacking the notion of the diplomat as being completely old hat. When the plane landed, he suddenly realised that he, as a minister of the Crown, had too much grog on him. And so it was my job to, me, virtually a teetotaler, to bring the minister's grog through customs, which, of course, I was happy to do. There were also times when I had to smuggle information. When John decided that the drover's dog had to go, that Bill Hayden's leadership of the ALP was doomed, it was very difficult for him because John was very fond of Bill. But he had to swear. I don't know what he swore on because John, I think, was a lifelong atheist. But he had to swear on something, that he wouldn't talk to Hawke. And Hawke had to promise that he wouldn't talk to John. So guess what? I'd be sitting on the phone, I'd have two phones, John on one phone, Hawkey on the other, and I'd be passing information. In that way, the plot could go ahead and they could both honour their promise not to talk to each other about it. The Friday programme, of course, classic, will be a replay of a chat I had with John. Astonishingly, it was about a decade ago when he wrote his memoir, As It Happened, and it ranges from childhood through to the end of his parliamentary career. And at the end, I say to him, you've got another good 20 years in you. Well, then in the end, he had another 10. His dad was a Presbyterian minister, as mine was a Congo minister. But John's dad, he describes as remote, aloof, very tough on him, but a very good preacher. And there's a nice little excerpt I've taken out where he's talking about his childhood Sunday school teacher, Miss Purvis, who was a fearsome fundamentalist whose treatment of young John was too much even for his father to take.
Miss Purvis was our Sunday school teacher, and she wore a black bonnet and button-up boots, high boots, and she used to play the organ in Sunday school. And she was pretty good on that hymn, Shall We Gather at the River, the beautiful river.
Shall we gather at the river,
the beautiful river. And she used to belt this out on the organ and the seat would sway back and forth and creak in time with the music. But she was a very fundamentalist Christian. And there was an incident one day when she said I had dirty shoes. And why hadn't I cleaned them before coming to Sunday school? I said, I hadn't had time. She said, well, you should have cleaned them on Saturday. I said, I was away on Saturday. And she said, Saturday should be spent preparing for the Sabbath. And she admonished me. I told my father that because I saw it developing as a sort of major scandal. And he was incensed about that. And I thought he was going to do something terrible. But what he in fact didn't was say to me, you're not going to Sunday school anymore. I don't want you taught that like that. So at the age of 8, I think it was, I stopped going to Sunday school.
Ah, John, what a fella. When people tell you that all politicians are shonks, think of people, think of John Button. He's not alone, but he's one of the best. And I miss him terribly. Bruce Shapiro, welcome to our little program. You're at home at the moment, are you, or are you elsewhere?
No, I am indeed at home this morning.
Okay, tell us what goes through your mind when we contemplate the 40th anniversary of the Luther King assassination.
Indeed, Martin Luther King assassinated in Memphis 40 years ago on April 6th. A lot of attention to this. I found my own associations immediately very personal. I was about 10 years old at the time, growing up in a suburb of New York, a community that had a large African-American neighborhood. Our schools were immediately shut down. There were some disturbances in the downtown area of Stamford, Connecticut, as I remember it. But the really vivid memory I have is of a bitter contrast. The day after he was assassinated, or rather the day of his funeral, we had off from school. I was at home, and I saw, the funeral was on television, and I remember my mother standing in front of the ironing board, watching the funeral on television and weeping. And, you know, I didn't understand too much of this, but I had some sense of what the stakes were. I then went over to a friend's house up the street, and being the day off from school, went to play, and there was his mother, another white family, and the mother was singing a little ditty. She was singing, "A tisket, a tasket, Martin Luther King's in a casket," and the power of that contrast stayed with me, still stays with me to this day. There is a sense that America has been divided ever since into those who were weeping at King's assassination and those who overtly or covertly greeted the moment with dismissal and derision. And you see that playing out even today in our politics.
Mm. What a story.
Well, you know, it was also, the thing to remember, too, is that King's assassination happened at a time when his own politics of nonviolence were in eclipse from both the right and the left. The war in Vietnam, the long, painful battle to desegregate America, a battle which in many ways failed, actually. I was in Chicago last week, a city that King had to flee from. He tried to segregate the North, desegregate the North. Housing in Chicago failed. Bitter riots there. There's a way in which King had played out his ball of string, and the right was openly roiling resentment in 1968, racial resentment, Richard Nixon, George Wallace all playing to it. The left kind of gave up, and we had a generation of political despair, really, a couple generations, that followed that moment. And we are still seeing that in today's campaign, the kind of play to racial tension on the one hand that you see coming at times from the Clinton campaign.
Plenty of dog whistle politics at the moment.
Indeed. And on the other hand, you can say, well, we have both Obama and Hillary running for president at all. This is a tribute to King. We have John McCain last week going to Memphis to commemorate the anniversary and apologizing for having voted against a Martin Luther King national holiday. So it's a watershed moment 40 years ago today, and the drama is not yet over.
Okay, well, a change of gear. Tell me about the sudden departure of Mark Penn from Hillary's campaign.
Well, you know, this has been one of those roller coaster weeks in American politics. Mark Penn, Clinton's chief strategist, pollster, crucial to the Pennsylvania primary coming up in 2 weeks, are, of course, the interests.
Does he change his name for every? For every primary.
He was Mark Iowa a few months ago. That's right. But crucial to Clinton's prospects in there is rousing the interests and loyalty of working class voters, and she's been doing that particularly by championing her opposition, her criticism now to the North American Free Trade Agreement, the pioneering legislation promoting economic globalization, which many American unions have opposed and which certainly has helped encourage a flood of jobs to the South and elsewhere around the globe. Bill Clinton supported NAFTA at the time. Hillary has said that she opposes the thing. And it turns out that Mark Penn, her campaign manager, was at the same time that he was working for her, was being employed as a lobbyist by the Colombian government for a sort of successor to NAFTA, the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, which many unions opposed. And when this became clear last week, Penn abruptly withdrew, leaving Hillary to, for the second time in 2 months, to reconstruct her campaign leadership and try to get through the Pennsylvania primary without losing more ground. The sort of astonishing thing for those of us who have been watching politics for a long time is not only that Penn would do this, but that Hillary would tolerate a campaign advisor who is also acting as if he has time to work for other clients. It's a kind of astonishing bit of political judgment all around.
You'll get a phone call. You'll have to join the Clinton team. They're running out of other top-level advisors.
Yeah, you may lose me yet, Philip. I don't know.
I lost David Brooks. I mean, it's only a matter of time.
Well, the interesting thing is that it gives both Obama and Clinton an opening going into the Pennsylvania primary. For Obama, it creates the first opening he's had for a while to talk about his own positions on trade and to criticize Hillary for being, you know, insufficiently active and sincere on these issues. Obama himself took some knocks a few months ago on trade when his campaign had written to Canadian economists was floated. For Hillary, the opportunity is to change her message, to turn into perhaps a more positive message after beating up on Reverend Wright, to re-spin the campaign a little bit. And what everybody now understands is her one opportunity to regain serious momentum, and a narrow, limited opportunity at that. So it's a make-or-break moment. She's promoted a couple of the campaign's current advisors to the top of the kitchen, and we'll see how it ends up. But it's been quite a week.
Bruce Shapiro, a pleasure doing business with you, journalist with The Nation, Executive Director of DART Centre for Journalism and Trauma at the University of Washington, on Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable on your pod, Music Maestro, please, and then Stephen Starr will tell us what the hell nuclear war might have to do with climate change. And before I introduce Stephen, there's another matter I wish to raise with you, and that is the loss of another dear friend at the weekend. You didn't know this woman, and if you had, you would have loved her as much as I did. Her name was Sheila Dixon. She was married to the filmmaker John Dixon, and John and Sheila kept an eye on me from my late teens for quite some time. John died some years ago. And the other day I got an email from Sheila, whose health had been pretty rotten and had been on dialysis forever, announcing that she decided it was time to check out. And she died as bravely and with the same good humour as she'd lived, with her daughters sitting on either side of the bed holding her hand. Sheila was a wonderful woman. She was feisty, she was funny, and I'm going to miss her terribly. Global warming, peak oil, terrorism, given the range of self-created catastrophes facing us in the 21st century, it's not surprising that the threat which loomed largest over the last century, nuclear war and its aftermath, a nuclear winter, has receded somewhat from public consciousness. Not entirely from ours. We've returned to the issue of the bomb problem quite often in recent years. Now, a decrease in the world's attention does not coincide with a decrease in the problem, quite the contrary. Last year I spoke with journalist William Longvisha about the proliferation of weapons, and nuclear weapons, in the Third World. You'll recall his book, The Atomic Bazaar, came to the depressing conclusion that nuclear warfare was becoming more likely rather than less. Enter Stephen Starr. Stephen has concentrated his efforts on bringing to our attention, or trying to, what such a conflict would mean for the world's climate, and more hopefully on how nuclear superpowers can, if they have the will, take immediate steps to lessen the likelihood of nuclear warfare. Stephen is an independent author and lobbyist. He's a member of the International Network of Engineers and Scientists Against Proliferation, which is one of the longest names I've ever had to deal with. And he's been in Australia on a speaking tour, sitting opposite me in our Sydney studio. Welcome, Steve.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Most of us now accept that climate change is, caused by global warming, is our most urgent challenge. But you argue that that climate change as a result of nuclear conflict is of equal concern.
Yes, I've been working with a number of scientists in the United States that just have had new research published that indicates that even a tiny fraction of the global nuclear arsenal would result in catastrophic changes in the global climate.
That's what you were trying to show me on your laptop.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and unfortunately we can't share that with the listener. Now, Pakistan and India are only minor minnows in the nuclear pond. But what would be the climate consequences of a nuclear conflict, well, between them?
Well, if they used their current nuclear arsenals, 50 Hiroshima-sized weapons on each side detonated in the largest cities of the other country, within a few days, global temperatures would drop to pre-industrial levels. The reason this would happen was because the smoke from the cities would rise up into the stratosphere and block the sunlight, be distributed globally. The effects of this climatically would actually be about 10 times worse than occurred in 1815 with the largest volcanic eruption in the last 500 years. The new studies indicate that the temperature drops would prevent wheat from being grown in Canada for a couple of years, for example. So the end result is that the countries that export grain would stop doing so, and probably most of the hungry people in the world would wind up starving to death.
We're going to do a program shortly on technological big fix arguments, where technology can be wheeled in on monstrous scales to sort out climate change. It worries me even to postulate these arguments, because it means that people can say, oh, well, I don't have to worry. There are people mad enough, Stephen, are there not, to suggest that a bit of a nuclear winter might be a quick fix for this problem?
Well, if they do so, they misunderstand the basic issue. The nuclear winter will last a matter of years, but when the smoke subsides, then the winter will subside, although one of the aspects of that is that in conjunction with the destruction of everything that we've talked about with ecosystems, there also will be destruction of ozone layer, and there will be probably a 80 or 90% increase in ultraviolet light that reaches the surface of the planet. But this is something that over time will go away, but the results are so catastrophic that, you know, there won't be many people left, unfortunately.
We've known, have we not? When I say we, the scientific community at least, have known about this nuclear winter scenario for decades.
Well, it was first introduced in the 1980s. And that time, the climate models were primitive by today's standards, as were the computers. But at that time, it also got a lot of recognition globally. It did coincide with the reduction of global arsenals from a level of 65,000 weapons in 1986 to about 25,000 now. But there was a concerted effort to denigrate the information. The scientists had actually were called irresponsible for putting these arguments out because the nuclear weapons establishment fought this idea. It was bad news for business, essentially.
Well, we can't have that, can we?
Well, no. Well, for almost 17 years, nuclear winter hasn't been discussed because the campaign to smear it was so successful that even members in the anti-nuclear weapons community came to believe that the research had been discredited.
The last time I looked, the Russians had about 9,000 missiles ticking away in various stages of disrepair. The United States, at least as many. There's a huge arsenal, isn't there?
Yeah. Even though the Cold War supposedly ended in 1991, the U.S. and Russia still have several thousand warheads that they can launch in a matter of just a few minutes. And that's what I've been working with the ambassador from New Zealand. Last October, I did a presentation to support a resolution that New Zealand passed through the General Assembly at the UN that called for the removal of these weapon systems from high alert status. But
I understand that Australia abstained from voting.
Yes, they did. They didn't vote against it, but they didn't vote for it. So part of my efforts here have been to meet with your ministry officials to try to show them some of this new research that shows just how cataclysmic nuclear war would be to the global climate and encourage them to change their position on this resolution.
Okay, so in pretty much instantaneously, a couple of thousand nuclear warheads in US and Russia could be launched.
Yes, even though Bush and Putin talked that the Cold War's over, they still have a guy standing about 10 feet behind them with a little briefcase that allows them to, within 2 minutes, launch almost 1,000 missiles with 2,600 warheads. And each one of these warheads has an average destructive power of about 275 million kilograms of TNT. When it detonates, it creates temperatures four times hotter than the center of the sun, and it will instantaneously start an area of about 150 square kilometers on fire. This is what causes these mass fires to be produced. And a number of these, you know, when you have 1,000 of these instantly taking place around the planet, the smoke from this will rise up into the stratosphere, block the sunlight, and cause the climate change.
It can be argued that mad, mutual assured destruction prevented a nuclear war, but we've always lived in terror, and certainly I have throughout my life, of nuclear war by accident. And I would have thought that that's an urgent consideration given the decaying Russian technical systems.
Yes, it has been a big concern. Russia only has about 3 out of 22 of its early warning satellites that still function. They lost a lot of...
Sorry, how many?
Three out of 22. Because of that, in 1995, there was a Norwegian missile launch that took place that the Russians weren't able to ascertain was headed towards the North Pole. And so they went to full alert. They opened the nuclear briefcases for the first time. And because of the way this works, because these ballistic missiles have at the most 30 minutes from when they're launched to reach their targets, a submarine-launched ballistic missile from the North Sea will hit Moscow in about 15 minutes. So they have a
So the window of opportunity to make a rational decision.
They're given about 3 to 7 minutes at the most to decide whether to launch a retaliatory nuclear strike. That's what I first started writing about, was the dangers of what they call launch on warning. It's associated with these high-alert arsenals. From in the 1960s, when they first developed missiles that they could launch in a matter of a few minutes, then they developed early warning system to detect this launch, but both sides lived in fear of a sneak attack. Unfortunately, it appears, I have a Russian colonel friend who was in charge of the Russian nuclear command and control system for 8 years. And he tells me that in Russia, they still utilize launch and warning policy. And there's a guy named Bruce Blair in the United States who is a former Minuteman launch officer. He works at the Brookings Institution now, but he says the same thing about U.S. policy. The U.S. won't admit it. But the bottom line is that because of this launch and warning policy, there's still the distinct possibility that if a perceived attack is coming in through the air, that they will launch a retaliatory nuclear strike before any nuclear detonations occur to confirm the attack arrived.
Oops, in a big way. Right. Okay, what was the response at the UN to the New Zealand proposal for the removal of all nuclear weapons from high alert status?
Well, the final vote was 136-3, and it passed. The only three nations voting against it were the United States, Great Britain, and France.
With us abstaining.
Yes.
And Russia.
Yes, Russia abstained.
Russia was
absent, actually, I believe. I'm not sure, but they didn't vote against it.
Now, before voting no, your government hampered discussion of the issue at the UN through some fairly skilled semantic gymnastics.
Yes, it was very unfortunate. The United States, in their opening statement, said that U.S. weapons are not now and have never been on, they called it hair trigger alert instead of high alert, which was the phrase New Zealand used. But the whole point of this was to obscure the debate. See, these terms don't appear in military dictionaries. And so part of my purpose there was to help clarify these issues. And it's a historical fact that these weapons can be launched in a few minutes. It's not a new idea, so it was ludicrous that the United States contended that these weapons could not, in fact, be launched.
Stephen, our last Labor Prime Minister, Paul Keating, cared passionately about nuclear issues and worked damned hard to get an international agreement moving. Of course, this seems preposterous and pretentious, but it's better to have a prime minister who feels that way than one who doesn't. What response are you getting from the Rudd government?
Well, I feel like we met with the Assistant Secretary for Arms Control in the Department of Foreign Affairs, Ian Biggs, and he was very gracious and very interested, and it was quite clear that they care very much about their work. And I am hopeful that they will change their position as in regard to the New Zealand efforts and bring Australia into the group of...
We have been signing a few international agreements lately after a long sulk.
Well, I hope the United States comes to the same position at some point.
Well, there's some chance there, isn't there? Because I understand that that two, at least, perhaps even three of your presidential contenders are sympathetic to this line
of argument. Yes, I believe both Democratic contenders have stated, and Obama probably more firmly than Clinton, that they will remove nuclear weapons from high alert status.
McCain,
I'm not quite so sure. I hope so. It's not as well defined.
I'm interested in how you pursued your crusade. You're a one-man band, basically. You go around the world trying to make people pay attention. How are you funded? Do you just sort of pay your own way?
Well, it's a mix. I pay for some of my expenses, and I have a retired English physician friend, Dr. Alan Phillips, we co-authored an article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in 2004 about the dangers of launch on warning. He's a brilliant man. He actually pioneered a lot of these ideas. He's been writing about them for a long time. So he's helping pay for the trip, too.
I've seen other lonely, valiant people win. One of them is the current and somewhat injured president of East Timor. He used to come in, sit there where you're sitting, years and years and years, talking about East Timor gaining its independence, and I always thought that was hopeless. Well, they bloody well brought it off, though it's troubled. They've done it.
You know, I don't want to portray myself as a lone individual. There's amazing people that are working on this. There's a guy named Alan Ware from New Zealand who has got 500 parliamentarians from around the world that are working on this.
500?
Yes, they're meeting in Canada at Pugwash in July to discuss this. Things are changing. Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry all came out in favor of the abolition of nuclear weapons. And the reason is because I think part of it has to do with this research on climate change.
Yeah.
It's just that suicide is not a defense.
No, it isn't. And the modeling you showed me on your laptop derives from that immense amount of computer power,
right,
which is doing the modeling on climate change now.
Well, literally tens and even hundreds of millions of tons of smoke will come from the result of these burning of cities. It's incredible. If a full-scale nuclear war takes place, they predict 150 million tons of smoke will rise up within a few days. 70%, 80% of the sunlight in the northern hemisphere will be blocked. In the southern hemisphere, it will be 35 to 40%. That will drop temperatures globally to much colder than they were 18,000 years ago, the coldest part of the last ice age. And minimum daily temperatures will fall below freezing for as many as 2 to 3 years. We won't be able to grow food. Even the high alert arsenals alone would be enough to accomplish 4 or 5 degrees Celsius drop globally average. But that's when you say a 5 degrees Celsius drop, it's a little, that's an average temperature. When you get into the center of the continents, you're talking about 20 to 30 degrees Celsius drop. Mm. As winter, summer becomes winter when this happens. It's in a matter of a few days.
Stephen, more power to your crusade. Stephen Starr, an independent author and lobbyist and member of the International Network of Engineers and Scientists Against Proliferation. You can find links to Stephen's work, including the new climate modelling on nuclear war, via our website. That's abc.net.au/rn/late-night-live. Stephen, thanks for coming.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Now let us see if we can get rid of the convict stain. I forgot to press a little red button. Now, for generations, Australians who had a convict past or convict ancestors strove to hide their shameful legacy, that so-called convict stain, the original sin of the Southern Hemisphere. Most people preferred to describe themselves as free settlers, even one of the best known. And respected former convicts, Mary Reby, once tried to alter her own history as a horse thief by claiming on the 1828 census that she was a settler who came free, quote-unquote, on the ship the Mariner in 1821. But the 1970s apparently saw the about turn, and a convict past became fascinating, and everyone began to scour the state archives for their convict connections, and I cannot tell you how ashamed I was to discover that all my antecedents were very boring. Boring as batshit. My next guest, Babette Smith, believes there is much more behind the habit of hiding our convict past than we might have originally thought. And she reckons the notion of a convict stain was partly manufactured and was the result of, well, I'm not going to tell you, let her tell you. Babette is an independent historian and the author of the best-selling account of the lives of a shipload of female convicts, A Cargo of Women, damn good book. Her new book is called Australia's Birthday, The Startling Legacy of the Convict Era, and she's going to startle us right now in the Sydney studio. Okay, Babette, startle me.
I'll do my best, Philip. I'm not sure that's possible, is it? I didn't anticipate what I'd find with this book. I knew that from past research with Cargo of Women that there was some kind of birth stain that did affect us, I thought, today. And what I found, amazingly, because the popular view was any cover-up of convicts, any shame, was a purely snobbish reaction of descendants of convicts and perhaps of the wider community. But what I found was there had actually been, around 1845, 1850, a shaming campaign which was part of the push by some newly arrived immigrants to end transportation.
Now, you point out that many convict buildings were destroyed, convict place names were changed. Well, Van Diemen's Land, of course, becomes Tasmania. But convict records also had the habit of disappearing.
Indeed they did.
Does Keith Windschuttle know about this?
I don't know. I don't think convicts are his bag.
But, no, but he goes, everything's got to be in writing for Keith.
Yes, that's true. But with family historians are able to fill some of the gaps that destroyed records left. And also, although they thought they'd destroyed everything with, for instance, in New South Wales, the destruction of the records of the superintendent of convicts, they overlooked the correspondence of the colonial secretary. So by coming in sideways, you can reconstruct these convicts' lives much more than those who were into the destruction they anticipated.
But was there a pre-Steyn era, given that so many of the people that founded our great nation, you know, had this in common? Surely in the beginning it wasn't seen as a stain, it was simply a fact of life.
Well, that's exactly what it was, a fact of life. And there was a pre-Steyn era, but that's not part of our community consciousness today, because most of what we think we know about the convict era is actually based on the propaganda of the anti-transportationists.
Now, this is the big revelation, these anti-transportationists. Let me ask you this. My antecedents were dead boring, as I've said. Do you have the convict stain?
I do. Two of them, yes.
Is that right?
A London pickpocket and a Nottingham woman, a woman who was in the slums of Nottingham with four children and no way of feeding them.
Can we swap our ancestors?
No, I'll keep mine.
Okay, tell us about this anti-transportationist thing.
Well, in fact, we had 60 to 70 years of a very strongly developing community in Tasmania, or Van Diemen's Land as it was, and New South Wales, with its own ethos and with some qualities that we would admire today. But when these
Or dwell on that, because that's a part of your argument, that many of the things we now claim as being a part of the Australian tradition derive from these values.
Certainly they do.
Which the convicts brought with them.
And because we didn't know the convicts, we can't trace the origins of those qualities. And one of the, I think, most distinctive and heartening to realise goes back that far is our sense of humour. Our national sense of humour, which is so strong in everything from our cartoonists to the way we reacted to the Olympic Games, so many ways. Nobody thinks...
I find it almost totally absent among the right wing, but let's not get into contemporary politics.
No, let's not. It ruins history.
So the sense of humour.
Yes.
It's a black humour, isn't it?
It is a black. It's a gallows humour. And you can see it in the trials in England, and you can see it in use on the ship coming out and in relations with employers or even with each other here in the colony.
Okay, there's a good start, a sense of humour. Come on, add to the pile.
Well, the other thing was that I think we've really overlooked was that the criminal conviction rendered everyone equal. There were solicitors, architects, London jewel thieves, forgers, bigamists.
Fallen members of the aristocracy? Not many of those?
We had the odd black sheep, but not many of those. But they, one way or another, they were all convicted in a British court of law, so nobody could put on side out here. And they overwhelmingly had the numbers. This is another thing we underestimate. The size of polite society could, you know, it amounted to a few hundred. But the convicts and the emancipists and their families amounted to thousands.
Your book points out that the qualities we most remember and admire about the First World War diggers were inherited directly from the convicts. Not just humour, but wit, daring, opportunism, the ability to keep your nerve, the courage not to weep, the stoicism to endure, and the determination to find a way when everything is ranged against you.
Yes, and that's when you study the trials of the convicts and their behaviour here in the colony, those qualities come out again and again.
What about our alleged hostility to the powerful?
Well, again, the other side of the humour was the use of cheek to cut through pomposity and people in power. So I'm not sure about the hostility, but the willingness to take them on, to be irreverent when they expected you to acknowledge your subordination, that kind of thing.
It's funny, I mentioned John Dixon before, whose wife died at the weekend. John was an old mate of mine, and he was also, when he wasn't making movies, he had a reconnaissance squad in the army. In fact, he got me to join briefly.
Ooh.
And he was a part-time military historian. And he made the point about the World War One diggers that they were so damned egalitarian that they were almost impervious. Well, let me phrase it differently. If the British soldiers saw one of their officers shot, they got a bit confused and worried.
Mm-hmm.
The Australians didn't,
mm.
because it was a flat,
yes,
non-hierarchical attitude.
That's right.
To war. And John argues that the Israelis, in fact, took the Australian AIF as their model.
Is that so? That's very interesting.
The same, yes, egalitarian,
yes,
sense.
There's a story around I read a while back about Tom Hughes, the QC, doyen of the New South Wales Bar, who was in the army during the war, and all the officers got shot. And the men immediately elected Tom, the leader. Now, you know, it takes our army to do that kind of thing.
But this is good stuff, isn't it?
Very
and so
good.
Here we are for generations being embarrassed by what we should have been celebrating.
And missing all this good stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
Raised in an egalitarian community that emphasised respect for the person rather than the badge.
Yes, and that's a great quality, actually. And the fact it began so early and in convict days means it's had a long currency here, and we have not been aware of it.
Well, the Army, the First World War, was one place we might observe this phenomenon, but was also seen on the goldfields, wasn't it?
Yes, and that has been somewhat celebrated. For me, a convict historian, a little marred by the fact that people said it began there and that it was all these new settlers arriving to find gold and they invented it. So it's a bit frustrating for me, that legend, because I would like people to understand it went further back.
Are we dealing with, I don't believe in repressed memory, but are we dealing in a sense with a form of repressed memory?
Yes, I wouldn't actually argue against that. I think there are elements of it.
So we're willfully ignorant, are we?
Yes and no. People did genuinely lose the memory because I saw family historians, and of course I was one myself. We did not know about that convict ancestor. We weren't just covering them up to produce them when it became fashionable, as people say.
Let me quote you to you because you write very well. Australian history gyrated simplistically around hollow men and confected issues. The search for drama, any kind of drama, other than the real one,
yes,
created villains from ordinary squatters and pastoralists and employers, many of whom were actually convicts or descendants,
yes,
of convicts, and underdogs like gold diggers, shearers and poor immigrants.
Mm. Well, more of our history than we realise, I think, has been a case of steering away from the convicts. A lot of emphasis has been put on Eureka. It was a robust fight over licence fees, but I don't think it was any more than that. But many have tried to make something more out of it. And you and I probably both remember how in our childhood you'd go to some kind of festive parade or the Royal Easter Show, and you'd be confronted by sheaves of wheat and merino sheep and large apples, and it didn't gel.
There's one proposition of yours which almost echoes Windschuttle. You argue that the national legacy of self-hatred amongst intellectual Australians has affected our perceptions, has denied the right to pride and affection for the history.
Yes. It was unfortunate for us that after the anti-transportationists laid down this appalling template, which included enormous contempt for the people who were, in fact, the ex-convicts, and, of course, the anti-transportationists were among those who brought education to Australia.
What was their motivation in being anti-transportationists?
They had come to Australia between 1838 and 1843, roughly, and their views of Australia had been formed in Britain by mainly, not entirely, but mainly the publicity from the Select Committee of the House of Commons, chaired by Sir William Molesworth. Now, there'd been select committees of the British Parliament looking into Botany Bay since we were founded, and they'd done over the women, called them prostitutes, depraved, you know, just terrible things about the women, but they got into the men and the sex life of the men in this particular select committee.
Look, dwell on that a little, because I found this fascinating. In a sense, convicts were often seen or misrepresented as being gay.
Yeah, well, yes. I don't think there was probably any more homosexuality amongst the convicts than there is in a normal community today. But there was a real scare campaign. There's some statistics that have come to light really about 12 years ago in Tasmania, which shows a record of those committed for what they then called unnatural crime. And it was like 1842, 1. 1843,
3. Oh,
1844,
it's an epidemic,
1.
For
heaven's sake. And then 1846,
19.
It leapt.
So how did women play into this? There was a change of policy, was there not?
Well, I think there have been some assumptions around the convicts' only option for marriage was women convicts. That was not true.
Or kangaroos. And
yes, that's
limited,
right.
Yeah.
Many married immigrants, either female immigrants brought to the colony under the bounty scheme or daughters who came with their parents as immigrants. So that evened up things a bit. We still have
imbalance. Sorry, run that past me again. Daughters who came with their parents.
I'm sorry, I wasn't very clear. There was a swelling up of immigrant families in the late 30s, and you'd get the father, the mother, and perhaps a couple of daughters and a
right.
son. Some of those women married convict men.
Ah, okay.
They intermingled much more than we've ever allowed for.
Was there an attempt to completely replicate Britain here? You know, later on, of course, we get the Bunyip aristocracy of... and some of the attempts to dress us up.
There wasn't an attempt to replicate Britain in the early days, at least not amongst the people at large. There may have been amongst a few officials and the odd clergyman. But basically the thing that people at large feared most was that England would be replicated in all its class privileges.
Yeah.
And that the community that they had created here themselves, where they were part of it, they weren't outcasts, they had the chance of a stake in it, which many took, they were terrified they would be overwhelmed by immigrants who would change that, and indeed they were in the end.
Tell me about John MacArthur's views.
Look, I don't know, but I think John MacArthur was probably an opportunist who made the most of his chances. I think from the point of view of this debate in this book, his son James is more interesting because he was born here and he loved the place.
Right.
And like Wentworth, who was also born here but of convict parentage, he also loved the place. And in the 1840s, they reconciled, those two men, the two strands of exclusive and emancipist. And I think it was the anti-transportation debate that brought them together as much as anything.
Babette, I know that historians hate to hypothesise, but if nothing had happened, if there'd been no campaign to belittle convict heritage, would we be, do you think, a substantially different nation today?
I think at our core we'd be a much more confident nation, much better aware of what we were capable of, and I think we would be more cohesive. I think there's been what might be called a social fault line running through our society since the anti-transportation campaigns that
ever
I don't
since.
Think we've been aware of.
Well, I spent most of my adult life in the national identity business. That was the argument for
yes.
the film industry cranking
yes,
it up.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. And a lot of other activities. We really do have, or we are in fact full of self-doubt about who the hell we are.
Yes. One of the cultural analysts, James Jupp, I think he put his finger on it when he said there was an idea that once Australians had an identity that they subsequently lost. I think that is the finger of the anti-transportation campaign. That's its legacy.
But, Bette, I suddenly remember my first meeting with Don Dunstan when he was a shiny, bright new premier, and he told me very proudly that South Australia had not been founded by convicts. I think they were Cornish tin miners or something.
And but, Germans.
And he was thought this was pretty bloody good.
Yes.
And you note that in the 1840s, Victoria and South Australia proclaimed themselves convict-free, and Victoria saw itself as an ocean of purity between two sinks of iniquity.
It's wonderful, isn't it? That also was part of the anti-transportation campaign. They went national. John West, who was driving it, the Reverend John West, was based in Tasmania, but he was a very clever strategist. And in liaison with John Fairfax, his fellow Congregationalist, they made it a national movement, and Victoria and South Australia were big players. But Victoria and South Australia, got lots of convicts. A.G.L. Shaw, the professor of history, he calculated 22,000 convicts crossed Bass Strait from Van Diemen's Land.
Wow.
And the South Australians got a lot too.
I'm astonished by this homosexuality subtext here. Mm. You note that Tasmania, and we note, because God help us, we took the program down to Tasmania to help, was the last Australian state to decriminalise homosexuality.
Yes.
Why was Tasmania so slow to recognise homosexual rights? Does this go back to your...
Oh, very much, because the anti-transportation campaign began in Launceston. It was its heartland. It spread widely over the other colonies and eventually pulled in New South Wales, which was initially reluctant. But the Tasmanians really felt it most severely.
If I had Robert Hughes sitting here, as he often has, would you get on well, or would you like to take him on the fatal shore?
Well, we were contemporaries at Sydney University, so I hope we would get on well. But, yeah, I would like to take him on, because I think he believed the sources. He didn't analyse them critically, which I did, and he didn't detect the scare campaign. He just believed that what the anti-transportationists had said was true.
A superficial view, and that's all, my views are always superficial, is that anti-transportationism sounds liberal, but you insist that it was deeply conservative.
Well, I do. They, however, cast themselves and appeared on the surface to be small L liberal, particularly in New South Wales, which was very caught up in moving to a democracy at the time. And they enlisted some radicals like Edward Hawkesley, the Chartist, and John Dunmore Lang, who was a true Republican. But the anti-transportationists themselves were deeply conservative and considerably homophobic.
We've only got a minute left, but tell us about the Reverend John West.
Well, of course, he not only, first of all, he understood the media and he used the media. The Launceston Examiner, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Argus were key drivers of the anti-transportation campaign. So he was much more than a clergyman. He was a strategist who understood the media. He was also, I think, probably a believer that he was mounting a great moral crusade, but I think it went... And he and it went over the top, and that's where he really did the damage.
Do you think your book is going to be welcomed with open arms by other historians, or are you going to...
I don't know.
Are you a troublemaker?
I tried to write evidence-based history, not a polemic, but I guess some people won't want to let go of their preconceptions.
I hope I haven't invited a subversive onto the program. Australia's Birth Stain, the Startling Legacy of the Convict Era, and I am, in fact, deeply startled. Thank you, Babette Smith. It's published now by Unwin, and I must say, Unwin and Unwin have been doing some damn good things lately. If there's... Oh, OK, what are we doing on tomorrow? I don't know. It just says on... What are we doing tomorrow? That we're doing the Tet Offensive. This is my chat with this wonderful fellow who sent me the letter, Peter Young. You've got to listen to that, listeners. It's going to be fan-bloody-tastic. But between now and then, all I can offer you is Radio National's news and a little bit of Elena Katz-Chernin, Music Maestro.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.